Welcome to Dad's on the Air for the 23rd of December 2008. Welcome to the people joining us from around the world via live streaming. And don't forget, you can listen to the show later at our website, dadsontheair.net. Got an interesting show coming up with a tragic case. Ken Thompson will be talking to us about his son, Andrew, who has international child abduction case. The family court's taken the rare move of issuing a publication order, so we'll be talking about all that. And we also have a very interesting speech from Margaret Dent, who's one of the great commentators on men's issues in Australia these days. In the studio we have with us Greg Anderson.
Morning, John, and morning, listeners.
Phil York, Dad's in Distress.
Good morning, John. Good morning, everyone.
Ian Purdy, from ianpurdy.com.
Good morning, John. Good morning, everybody.
And myself, John. Thanks.
John Stapleton.
Thank you. So, all right. So, a bit of news around at the moment?
Bit of news, yeah. Editorial in this morning's Australian, under the heading A Testing Challenge, the sad picture of Indigenous children's literacy skills revealed by the National Assessment Program should serve as a catalyst for reforms. Results of Australia's first uniform testing of year 3, 5, 7 and 9 students have shown that the extent of illiteracy amongst Aboriginal children is higher than previously thought. The problem is most acute in the Northern Territory, where only 30% of Indigenous Year 3 children met national benchmarks in reading. In Queensland, 66% did so, and in Western Australia, 57% did so. Part of the problem, pinpointed by Centre for Independent Studies senior fellow Helen Hughes, is lack of English in remote classrooms. But either way, this is a bit of a shocking state of affairs for Indigenous children, the fact that they are not getting the education that they need to be successful parts of our society. That, you know, they're still going backwards, which is a terrible state of affairs. Something needs to be done about it. And in other news, of course, in the Telegraph this morning, this is shocking. On the front page, weapon war, crime wave prompts gun amnesty, knife crackdown. I mean, we've got the spate of murders, children going to parties, walking around the street with guns and knives and killing each other. There have been a number of shocking murders over the last couple of weeks. Yeah, children, basically, 15, 16, 17-year-olds stabbing and shooting each other, drive-by shootings. I mean, what's going on, people? This is supposed to be Sydney, not the Bronx, you know. It's all a bit tragic. We really got to stop arming these kids. We've got to stop letting kids go out and on the street with knives. They're getting murdered. 15-year-old boy murdered, and here's his parents crying with a photo of him. I mean, this is shocking stuff. Shocking, shocking stuff.
Yeah, there's been a quite a number of attacks just in the last few weeks.
Well, it's the festive season, you know. People go out with knives and guns, get a few drinks into them or whatever, and start killing each other. Yeah. It's horrifying. It's got to stop. It's got to stop.
I don't know how likely that is.
Yeah, well.
Well, Dad's on the Air has survived another year, remarkably enough. We're now, we'll be into our ninth year next year. We've survived for 8 years since we began in 2000. It's quite remarkable. One thing we would like to do in the coming year is to broaden our coverage of Australian events. So anyone out there who would like to contribute, as an individual or as an organisation or as a community group, you can contact us very easily through the website, and it would be great to get some more material from regional and rural parts of Australia.
Or yep, and more contributors.
So that would be great. If you've got any material or any ideas that you would like to see played on Dad's on the Air, by all means, contact us. Now, Phil, it's not the best time of year for a lot of blokes, is it?
Yeah, exactly right, mate. It is a really difficult time of year for lots of dads that's you know, maybe their first Christmas after separation, and stuff in regards to the kids' visitation, and that hasn't been sorted out yet. And you know, over the last week, my calls or numbers of calls during the day has just skyrocketed, you know, and it's dads that have rung up their ex-wife or their ex-partner and said, you know, what are we doing for Christmas? And, you know, they've had various responses, but basically all those responses come down to, no, get stuffed.
Man, it's so malicious. It's just awful.
It is, mate. It is, you know, and these dads are just beside themselves, you know. They don't know what to do. You know, Christmas is supposed to be a family time, and, you know, they're not only going through the emotional turmoil of their separation, but to have that added on top, you know, to sit there on Christmas Day and look at the presents that you've got for your kids and know that you don't have the opportunity to actually give it to them is just horrendous.
Yeah, it is. You can't, unless you've been through it, you can't actually describe the feelings of helplessness and futility and just hopelessness, and you just, the whole Christmas thing just turns around. It really does have fangs when you're stuck in that situation.
It does. So, you know, like for lots of people out there, you know, have a fantastic Christmas, but you know, just one thing I would say is, you know, if you're lucky enough to have your kids this Christmas, perhaps just give them an extra hug for those dads that don't have their kids this Christmas, because and just spare a thought for them, because it isn't an easy time. And, you know, over this particular time of year, we lose more dads to suicide than we do at any other time of the year. So
yeah, just tragic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you're a dad who's feeling, you know, can't see his kids and is feeling that loss and that pain, find a mate and talk to a mate. That's always a good thing. And
yep.
Share it with someone else. Or give Dads in Distress a call. Phil, what's the number again?
Yep, the number is 1-300-853-437. We also have a really good website. There's a forum on that. There's usually guys on that on Christmas Day as well. So, you know, if you've got internet access, go onto the website. If not, ring the 1300 number. And we'll be able to talk to you from there.
And there's a number of crisis numbers up on our website for Lifeline, as well as
Men's Line.
Men's Rights Agency also runs similar sorts.
So there's lots of help out there. So nobody has to sit around on their own feeling helpless. There's plenty of men's groups there. There's lots of blokes who know what you're going through, who want to help. So it's not hopeless.
So what's your overarching advice?
Well, I guess, you know, there's a couple of things that I try and say to fellas, and one is, you know, this time of year, the flip side is to it that it's almost the end of the year. You know, next year is a new year, and, you know, we can look proactively at making sure that next Christmas is a better one for you. And also, the other thing is you know, just hang in there and reach out, you know, find someone to talk to, as Greg said, you know, because just bottling it up and keeping it internal and, you know, sticking to yourself is doing yourself no good at all.
Yep.
And traditionally, of course, men find it extremely difficult to ask for help from anybody, even their best mates, or particularly their best mates, probably.
So yeah, and I guess that's where Dads in Distress comes in, because we truly know and we truly understand, you know. I'll put my hand up. I've gone through a shocking Christmas years ago, and I'm sure, you know, the guys around this table here have as well.
Oh, yeah.
Right, we're going to be back in a moment. We'll be talking with Ken Thompson.
Despite all Meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
So in a rare move, the Family Court of Australia has issued a publication order enabling the release of information about an international parental child abduction. Andrew John Thompson, now aged 4, was illegally abducted by his mother, Melinda Thompson, also known as Melinda Stratton, from Australia in April this year. On the line we have his father, Ken Thompson, who's a Deputy Fire Commissioner in New South Wales. Are you there, Ken?
Yes, I am, John. Good morning.
Good morning. So, it's a heartbreaking case, this. Maybe you should just begin at the beginning.
Yeah, it's a terrible situation. It just came like a bolt out of the blue, although in hindsight there were probably some warning signs. I just didn't realise what they were at the time, and I didn't realise the seriousness of the situation. I guess to start at the beginning, towards the end of this time last year, I became a little bit concerned that my wife was starting to become a bit paranoid about a few things. She was starting to express concerns that Andrew wasn't being looked after well at his daycare centre. That wasn't consistent with my experience there. Then she started to express concerns that Andrew was being bullied. Again, I didn't see any evidence of that. She then expressed some concerns that other people in general were not being friendly towards Andrew. And then eventually I became the target, and she formed a belief that I had been harming Andrew and that I had been harming him for quite some time. I just couldn't make any sense out of it whatsoever. Melinda left to go and visit her brother on the 1st of January. She didn't return, and she wouldn't allow me to have any contact with Andrew whatsoever.
But what did you do?
Well, she then wrote a letter saying that the marriage was over and that she demanded sole custody of Andrew with no access or no contact with me whatsoever for the rest of Andrew's life. And if I didn't agree to that, that she would take legal action. She also told me in the letter that there were several investigations underway that she didn't elaborate about the investigations, and I just at that point felt I had absolutely no other choice but to initiate legal action in the family court. That was the last thing I would ever have imagined doing. Melinda and I had a rock solid relationship, a wonderful wonderful son. We were very, very close. And I can still recall being in my lawyer's office with tears streaming down my face as I was signing the affidavits. I just couldn't believe I was doing it.
Oh, no, you're not the only one, of course, that this has happened to. Do you know the statistics for how many children are abducted each year in Australia?
I believe it's around about 3 children a week. I also believe the figure could be higher than that, because my understanding is that that's the figure that's recorded by the Attorney General's Department through the Central Authority, which is the organisation or the group that manages the Hague Convention in Australia. So if the children, as I understand it, children who are abducted and not taken to Hague Convention countries aren't captured in that data. So my understanding is it's at least 150 children a year, and it could be substantially more than that, which is just amazing, an amazing figure. I think if 150 children a year were disappearing on the streets of Sydney, there'd be just a national outcry, and we'd be doing whatever we could to prevent it.
So for those who don't know anything about the Hague Convention, can you just explain it all?
Yeah, the Hague Convention is a part of the United Nations Conventions on the Rights of the Child, and children do have rights. A lot of parents, a lot of us think they don't, but they have international rights that have been picked up in legislation in Australia, and the child has a right to have a relationship with both its parents, unless, of course, there's extremely serious circumstances that would prevent that. The child has a right to reside in its own country or its country of citizenship, and the child has a right to live within the child's culture. Now, of course, that doesn't always happen, and over many years, children have been abducted from countries. So the Hague Convention was established, I'm not quite sure how long ago, but maybe 20 years ago, and it's designed to enable the safe return of children from countries that are signatories to the Hague Convention. I'm not certain, I think it's about 170 countries that are signatories to the Hague Convention.
So there's quite a number that aren't.
There's quite a large number that aren't, and that makes it extremely difficult. If a child is abducted to a country that's not part of the Hague Convention, it's extremely difficult to get any support, because the government's model is designed around the Hague Convention, and as part of the Hague Convention, countries that are signatories must establish what they call a central authority, and that central authority in Australia is part of the Attorney General's Department. And because there is a convention, the government puts resources to that. Now, I'm not really quite sure what assistance they do offer to parents whose children have been abducted to other countries, but I know it's not as extensive as it would be for children who have been abducted to Hague countries. But even the Hague Convention is not perfect. There are quite a few countries in the world that aren't as compliant as others, and even though your child has a right to be returned under the Hague Convention, you generally have to initiate legal action in the court in the country in which the child is located, and then present your argument about why the child should be returned to its country of what they call habitual residence.
Of course, as we know full well here, doing this show for so many years, some dads manage to lose their kids and lose contact with their children while they're still in the same country, and sometimes even in the same suburb. But there are sometimes court orders preventing any contact. Has this whole experience made you more sympathetic to the plight of separated blokes in this country? Because there's never been much sympathy between intact and non-intact dads.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
So much. It's not a lesson I particularly wanted to learn, but no. I came in at the tail end of your interview before about dads with the person from Dads in Distress. And I've got to say, that organisation has been fabulous in helping me. It's given me a wonderful forum to go and share my experience and to learn about other people's experiences. But I've got to say, I had no idea about some of the difficulties and some of the issues that parents you know, have to deal with once their marriage breaks down and they find no other way other than to go to court. I'm a pretty balanced sort of person, so I think, you know, there are probably women's groups out there too where, you know, the women sort of have issues with the family court as well. But, you know, the only people I've met so far have been men, and some of the stories I've heard have been, you know, quite horrific and, you know, quite heartbreaking.
Yeah, there are some absolutely unbelievable stories.
But, just to go back, if I may, back to the actual abduction of Andrew itself. The court, when I went to court, the judge directed that I was to, that contact was to be re-established with Andrew. The judge provided what I since learned is an unprecedented level of contact. He ordered that I could have 2 hours every second day with Andrew, and that I was to have 2 hours on the alternating Saturdays and Sundays. So, you know, my lawyer said that was a very, very high level of contact.
We're great advocates of shared parenting here and cooperation after separation.
I mean, it was not what I wanted, but at least I had some contact with my son, and I hadn't seen him for 3 months at that point. I'd been given no word about his welfare, despite asking whenever I could get any contact with my wife. She just refused to give me any information whatsoever about Andrew. So the judge ordered an independent expert witness investigation, a psychiatric investigation. I was interviewed, my wife was interviewed, and Andrew, of course, was, wouldn't say interviewed, but he was observed. And then I spent 30 minutes with my son, and that was the first time I'd seen him in 3 months. My wife had alleged in her affidavit that Andrew was terrified of me, that Andrew was would scream whenever I was around. And I hadn't seen him for 3 months, and I barely recognised him because he'd gone from being almost a baby to a young boy. But he saw me, had a massive smile on his face. He came straight over, sat down beside me, and gave me a big hug. You know, so this was a child who, you know, was allegedly terrified of his father. So anyway, the psychiatrist provided his report to the court. He found that there was no basis to my wife's daughter Melinda's allegations, but that Melinda had an underlying mental state that was causing her to believe things that weren't true, and it was at the paranoid end of the spectrum. Now, unfortunately, she'd sacked her lawyer by this stage, so the report went to the court, and then it went straight to her. And she received the report, and about 7 or 8 days later, she went into a travel agent. She bought 2 tickets to Germany, and she flew out with Andrew the next day, and that's the last I've heard from them.
And it's just a heartbreaking thing, isn't it? I mean, can you describe the impact on yourself and on your own parents, I suppose? They've lost their grandkids. And
it's devastating. My mother's 88, and Andrew was, or is, her only biological grandchild. You know, I married late in life, and so did Melinda, and we had a child late in life, and we were actually both surprised that we were able to, you know, have a child, to tell you the truth. But it happened very, very quickly, and my mother was just absolutely over the moon. It was, you know, the thing that she'd wished for all her life. And she was very close to Andrew. She was very close to Melinda. And then, you know, I had to ring one day and say, look, the marriage is over, and I don't know where Andrew is. And then I had to, you know, 4 months later, give her the news that Andrew had been taken out of Australia, and I didn't know where he was. So you can imagine the effect on an 88-year-old woman. I mean, she's a very strong woman, and she's putting on a very brave front, but she's devastated. I know she's devastated. The rest of my family, Andrew's cousins, every time I see them, they're just a little bit older than Andrew, and they ask after him. They say, where's Andrew? And I, you know, I just get tears in my eyes, and I say, well, look, you know, he's not here today, you know, we'll see him at another time. And they don't quite, they can't understand what's going on, you know. So, you know, it's just, it's consuming my life, and it's, you know, taking a huge amount of effort on the part of my family to deal with it as well. I'm very lucky. I've got a couple of very, very close friends, and I think if it hadn't been for those friends, you know, my emotional state would be very, very different to what it is now.
We're going to take a quick break. You've got a phone number, haven't you, that you'd like people
yes.
with any sort of information that might... this goes up on the web, so it could be people in Germany, or do you think he's still in Germany?
I really don't know. The German police have conducted two extensive investigations in Germany, and they haven't been able to come up with any trace of them at all. My wife lived in Germany for about 6 years before she came to Australia, but she also lived in Paris, she lived in the UK, and she lived in Dubai. So she knows her way around extremely well. Germany was probably a place that she saw as, you know, a place for her to be comfortable in her own mind, I would imagine. But I would say once she settled down, she could well have moved on from there.
Right. We'll take a quick break and we'll be back.
Okay.
In distress, 1-300-853-437.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And welcome back to Dad's on the Air. Still on the line with us, we have Ken Thompson telling us about the tragic case of the international child abduction of his son, Andrew. Ken, could we continue telling the story? Once your wife left the country, could you let us know what support you received from Australian authorities, I guess from the family court and from the police? How's that help come about? Because it's been quite unprecedented that the family court has allowed publication of your story, I guess.
Yeah, look, the family court has been very, very good. The judge has been very sympathetic towards this case, and he has issued quite a large number of orders that have enabled me to do things that probably haven't been done before. The Australian authorities have been very good. I've been working very, very closely with the Australian Federal Police and the Attorney General's Department, the Central Authority, and DOCS in New South Wales. You know, it's a frustrating process, I must admit that. Information goes in and it takes a long time to get information back, but that's because they're liaising with other countries, and we have to work through several layers of bureaucracy and diplomacy in different countries to be able to, first of all, get people to actually, you know, commence an investigation, and then to provide us some feedback on that. But I'm in contact with particularly the DOCS in New South Wales and the Central Authority and the AFP on almost a daily basis by either telephone or email or face-to-face meetings.
Well, it's fantastic to hear that level of support. Obviously, it must be frustrating dealing with large bureaucracies, but it's good to know that they've been such a support. Have you... you've obviously tried to also... publicise this case yourself independently. Have you done? Obviously, you've been doing that in Australia, and your story's been has made the press. Have you tried doing that overseas to try and get the word out? Obviously, that would be potentially more useful, I guess, to try and find Andrew.
Yes, I needed to get something started in Australia first, and then use that to be able to get some international exposure, and that's what's happening. The judge had to be satisfied that we'd undertaken every other avenue of inquiry before going public, but we were able to demonstrate to him that there was nothing coming back through the normal channels, and he quite readily agreed to the publication order. We have picked up some media coverage internationally, particularly off the back of the Daily Telegraph story. They were very good. They were part of the Murdoch group, so they moved the story around the world. I'm working very closely with a group in the UK called Forever Searching. That's the organisation or the group that's leading the awareness campaign for Madeleine McCann, the little girl who was abducted from Portugal. Mm-hmm. They've taken Andrew's case on board. They see it as a very serious case because of Melinda's underlying mental state. They've got grave concerns for Andrew's welfare, and they've offered to help, and I'm working very closely with them on a media campaign in Europe, and also another group in Canada and another group in Australia. Now, of course, while that's happening, that's good. It takes time to get these things set up, though. But I've also been running a global email campaign, and I'm asking people to take part in that campaign. I provide some material, and I asked them to send that email to as many people as possible. Now, one organisation actually sent it to 10,000 people, which just blew me away.
Wow.
Other people have sent it to one or two people. It doesn't matter how many people this email gets to. The important thing is that it does get to people, and it's important that those people forward it on. An email sent to somebody in Parramatta can very easily turn up in a little town in the back of Paris. And who knows, that could be where they are.
So do you want to give our listeners the details of how they can take part in that email campaign?
Yes, at the moment I'm doing it, I'm hoping to establish a website, but that takes time. So if anybody would like to help in this global search for Andrew, they can contact me on 0417 416 024.
And if they just repeat the number, can you?
Yeah, that number again is 0417 416 024, and if they contact me and provide me with their email address, I'll send them the information, and then all I ask them to do is just send that to as many people as they possibly can.
Fantastic. And if listeners can also get in touch with us through our website, dadsontheair.net, and we'll happily forward any contacts on to Ken as well. So as we're obviously keen to play our part as well.
Great, thank you.
Now, what will happen potentially if you find Andrew? Do you actually know what the next step would be in terms of actually returning him safely to Australia?
If it's in a Hague Convention country, I have to lodge an application in the court in the country they're found in. I'm not quite sure exactly whether or not Melinda would be able to maintain any custody of Andrew in that country, because it will depend very much on the court. However, the psychiatrist's report does express very, very serious concerns about her ability to parent Andrew. I will go to wherever they're found as quickly as I can possibly get there. I would probably endeavour to have Andrew transferred to my care in that country, and then I'd have to work through the legal process in that country through the Hague process, and put an argument forward that Andrew needs to be returned to Australia for his own safety and well-being, and so that the legal process that was underway in Australia can resume, and the final arrangements for parenting can be put in place by the court.
All right, we better comply with another court order here. The court has also ordered that in any publication a warning must be issued stating that no one is to approach Melinda Thompson, and that any information should be provided immediately to local police and or Interpol.
Yeah, that's correct. I think that expresses quite well the concerns that the Family Court of Australia and the Australian Federal Police and the Attorney General's Department have for Andrew's welfare at the moment.
So if you know the welfare or the whereabouts of Andrew Thompson, now aged 4, contact his dad, Ken.
Yes.
I'd contact the police.
Anyone who might know anything. But at the moment, I don't think there would be too many people in Australia who does know where Melinda is. She hasn't been in contact with anyone, as far as we can tell. You know, what I'm looking for at the moment is people who are prepared to join in this campaign and help me get information out around the world.
We've been talking with Ken Thompson. He's the Deputy Fire Commissioner here in New South Wales, and a well-respected bloke who's suddenly and very unfortunately come face-to-face with what a lot of blokes go through in this country. Thank you very much for coming on to Dad's on the Air.
Thank you.
And all the best. Good luck with it, mate.
Yeah. Thank you very much, and thanks to everyone who's listening.
Yeah, best wishes.
Thanks.
Bye.
Raise a little thing all the way. Is it cold? I just Back in August, I attended the second national conference put on by the Men's Advisory Network in Fremantle, Western Australia, titled From Babies to Blokes, The Making of Men. Now, one of the highlights at that conference was a keynote by Maggie Dent. We had Maggie on the program just a few weeks ago talking about her recent book. So it's with great pleasure that we bring you this recording, recorded at the MAN conference in Western Australia. And we're going to start with an introduction by facilitator Jerry Gannon.
Okay, moving right along. Now, yesterday we heard from Magistrate Sue Gordon about the role of mothers in bringing up boys, and we heard her own very personal story about bringing up her own two boys and the problems she faced. We're revisiting that theme this morning with Maggie Dent, who's not only written extensively on the subject, she's also the mother of four sons, which is perhaps where most of her inspiration for her books comes from. Apart from being an author, she is, and I quote, a parenting and resilience specialist. And I guess with four sons, a certain amount of resilience is required. To talk to us about the healthy mothering of boys, please welcome, ladies and gentlemen, Maggie Dent.
I'd like to acknowledge that I respectfully stand on Noongar land and I pay deep respects to past, present and future custodians of country. My childhood was enriched by the Noongar kids who came to our farm during shearing time. They really taught me how to play and they shaped me in lots and lots of ways. I can't stand still because I'm a hyperactive kinesthetic learner, which 75% of boys are. So please forgive me wandering backwards and forwards or my brain goes into meltdown. I am also menopausal, so every moment, every now and then, I haven't got a damn clue what I was going to say next. I warn you right up front. Boys call it my M&M moments, and I remember at one point explaining it to number four son that I had menopause, and he came out a week later and said, "How long does the pause last?" Loved him, so sweet. And I am very keen to say that I am the woman I am because of the father I had, more than because of the mother I had. I was blessed, very blessed, with a wise, wonderful dad who believed in telling stories, laughing a lot, deeply connected to the land, to nature, to moments of exquisite oneness, who was a humanitarian, who was incredibly valued in his own community, which was a very small community. I come from Wandering. Anyone heard of it would know that's actually very cold there. Very cold. I guess as a resilience specialist, I had to learn that to become a resilience specialist, you can't stand up here and talk about things unless you've buggered up, really, lots of times. And I have, and I guess there's, if I went through the list, I won't do it today because I usually embarrass myself quite considerably. I have overcome nearly everything that you can as a woman on my journey. And so I can stand here with that credibility. It's not, resilience isn't just about bouncing back in some warm, fuzzy way. It's about conquering and living life as well as overcoming it when it sucks, because it does. As a resilience specialist, I've done enormous work at building resilience in children. And what I ended up creating was a 10 building block model based on Indigenous tribal ways of raising children, and I've just put it in a modern context. My credibility, I did lots of things. I'm a really weird human being. I kind of work at the dark edge to learn fast. And I did, other than 17 years in and around classrooms, particularly adolescents, and I loved the farting, burping boys that were 14. I loved them. I love their energy. I love their gutsiness. I love the fact that they didn't go, "Oh my God, is this the right thing to say?" And they just blurted out. I loved that energy. And that's why I was rather weird as a teacher. Fortunately, my biggest credibility doesn't come from teaching. It comes from the pack up here. You notice the stubby of beer. I had to fight at different times what was okay for my boys. And on every one of us in here has had a mother. What I've noticed in my years of therapy and working with troubled adolescents, and the cutters, the stabbers, the ones who want to kill themselves, the ones failing school and the ones with drug addiction, I could trace a lot of the wound back to what hadn't happened. The absence of healthy mothering. That absence of some part that wasn't fed. And in that journey, I kept wondering, okay, so
not enough, too much, where's the continuum? Now, before I continue, there's no such thing as perfect parenting. Big breath in, thank God for that. And there's no such thing as a perfect child. But I really believe in our modern world and in the way that we educate our teachers, boys are being conditioned early as being less than some sort of challenge or problem, and that they're not easy to contain because they don't learn how we'd like them to learn in classrooms. And that really worries me enormously. And I meet that right the way through to CEOs who come to me occasionally. So I've got this massive big promotion. Maybe any minute now they're going to work out that I'm just a useless prick. But I've just fooled everyone. And I can trace that back to in grade one when he stood up and read out loud out of his reading book and he got it wrong and everyone laughed at him. But any minute now I'm going to be exposed. That's how deep those things happen in our sensitive boys. Technically for me, this is the statement I'm going with healthy mothering. We're not going to Einstein too much about this. Yes, men can mother. Yes, other people other than mothers can mother. But for today, it's about the healthy mothering of the most significant mother that you have, whether it's an adopted mother or the one that gave birth to you. Okay, this is the model that I've come across after all these years of considering. What is it that shapes us? And some of you may resonate with this. What happens when you've got the frozen heart, cold bitch, or completely emotionally and physically absent mother? What happens to you when you become a man? What happens quite often in my journey of that is the emotionally armoured heart. A little bit like what Arnie said, you get this much because I've been kicked and walked on. That was from your experiences in first love. If your mother wasn't able to do that amazing attachment, stare into your eyes or provide for your needs at some other level, you harden up. And one of the men that really showed that to me enormously was a man who came, who'd been born in Kenya in Nairobi. And his mother was at the tennis club, of course, all the time, and frightfully English. And when she wasn't there, he was with black nannies. Well, she changed the black nannies every 3 to 4 months in case he got attached. So you imagine the abandonment that happened over and over again. And then he was shunted off to boarding school at 5, and they came home once a term. Now, the armouring on that man's chest, and I work actually with the body as well as a therapist, not just with your head, was like concrete. You know, I could not move his chest. It was such a rock wall. So he didn't not only feel love, he didn't feel anything. And he became quite hopelessly consumed by the fact he was about to lose his family. And the alcoholism was the only thing that numbed it for a short period of time. Beautiful, beautiful man. But that's the effect of armouring if we are not actually loved. Then the other side to that, and this can happen very early too, we're completely bloody smothered. Absolutely smothered and invaded on all levels. And that's a different wound. And you can see these boys when they come into my office, they're often very large with very puffy cheeks, quite boy-like in this big body. And you're right, honey, mum wants to come in. And I'm going, sorry, sorry, bye, outside. Oh no, but I want to be there. I said, well, it's actually about him right now. Honest to goodness, I'm sure her ear is at the office door. It's a bit like we ran a dad's only seminar with my adolescent initiative in Geraldton recently, and it was so funny because 8 women rang up the organiser and said, no, I want to be there. He said, no, it's dad's only and Maggie. Yeah, but I want to be there to see what goes on. Hello? There are women like that. I bet some of you men have met them. They want to know everything. That's what this invasive lack of boundaries does. They ask 9 million questions. And if you don't tell mum what's going on, she'll go and get the teacher. And she wants everything to be known. Now, we do know that we are. I don't care what anybody says. I really find that we do think differently. You know, I haven't met a man yet who can rationalise away the fact that he can eat 5 Tim Tams if he has skim milk with his coffee. I've met women who can do that. Unbelievable, unbelievable. So what my boys have told me over the years is because I had the perfect arrangement in my family, besides mum being the alcoholic and the unavailable, I had the perfect daughter above me, you know, who was squeaky clean and did all the yes, no and helped mummy out. So there wasn't a place for me to be the perfect daughter. So I was dad's mate. I was outside on the farm. And I could swear like the best of them. And every now and then, I'm sorry, the farm girl still comes out. Can I apologise ahead in case she slips out? I hope that word that rhymes with duck does not come out today. But what also I found was I learned to think like a bloke. I learned to not do all the overwording stuff. And I'm very pragmatic. And at different times, I had to learn how to be a woman. I had to learn how to think like a woman. I had to learn how to negotiate the whole fashion wardrobe bit. Because as my boys will say, I take less time to get ready than my husband does. I don't change any more than once. I drop before I shop. So I'm a seriously bloke kind of person in a female body, which has made it very easy for me in my work to decode to parents what's going on for boys, and particularly the adolescent boys, because that's the confusing and scariest time for me. So healthy mothering, we like to think, is somewhere in the centre, and we can wobble between the two, and I know the women in the room will know that. You know, I had moments when I could be a hissy fit, you know, complete bitch, but it usually was over quite quickly. And I wasn't the one that could sulk and manipulate for quite a few days afterwards. And what's really interesting, you don't notice if you're able to be completely in the centre part there. That means I provide space for my children. I'm going to touch some of the ways that we do healthy mothering. Later on, the boys came home once, the three of them were living in the city, and came home and said, "Oh, Mum, we had a bit of a chat over a few beers the other night about how you've buggered us up." And I thought, well, that's the right of us as parents. Everyone needs therapy. Get over it. Pay for your own. And he said, no, it's not a really bad way, but what we've worked out, because boys don't always have these conversations, do they, about how they're getting on with women. And they'd had this big conversation, and what they found was that any chick that they went out with who started doing sucky stuff about, oh, can't we go there, or 45 hours in the toilet, and does my bum look big in this, and all that sort of stuff, the boys go, well, we're either going or not, and that's it. They just would not stay. They wouldn't play the games. They said, just bullshit, stop doing it. And they're going, oh, how dare you say that? And they walk out. And I said, so why have I buggered you? He said, you've taught us not to be tolerant around that emotional sucky stuff. And I said, well, where have I buggered you up? And they said, well, because we can't find many chicks who don't do it. But there's another part they said, and I said, oh, he said, and the other thing is, you cook really well. We haven't found a chick who doesn't do emotional sucky stuff and cooks. So I said, great, go to the country. There might be one hiding out there somewhere. We know that early attachment's vitally important. We know there's lots and lots of that. We know, no, it shapes you forever. It shapes the neural development, so that your prefrontal lobe, and that's the big one I want you to remember today. We now know that the prefrontal lobe, the reasoning brain, doesn't really develop till in the 20s. And I say with great love and respect with girls, it's around 22, and boys anywhere from 22 to 80, really. Because depending on what has happened in healthy mothering, because it's the emotional reasoning, isn't it? That's the stuff. That didn't sort of happen with some really helpful stretching of thinking, like, so what do you think you could have done differently? Instead of smearing that all over the wall, sweetheart. Or that nail in Mum's nice sideboard. Do you know, where else could you have put that nail? It's very difficult, in the midst of moments that only boys could do, for us to refrain nicely. I love them. I remember one time we were selling a house, and so I had it all spick and span. They're all outside, and I'd fed them and pushed bikes out there, and the real estate agent came through, and everything was spick and span. He came out with a strange look on his face, and so did the people who were looking at the house. And I couldn't quite work out what it was. And I've gone right through the house, and I've come into the bedroom, my bedroom, and one of my lads had found a pack of sanitary pads that had sticky bits on the back, peeled off all the sticky bits, and had stuck them all over the wall. Not really what you want when you're trying to sell your house.
We'll be back with more of Maggie Dent from the Men's Advisory Network conference in Western Australia after this track.
So well hidden. nothing much gets done. And the light comes into dreamily, as there's never anyone. Time becomes an object. You forget that it exists, and the lonely eyes keep grazing.
Dad's on the Air. We're listening to Maggie Dent, author and parenting and resilience specialist. speaking at the MAN Second National Conference in Fremantle, Western Australia.
We know now that these sorts of things, many of the infant and child behaviours that are challenging parents were unheard of in cultures in the past because they weren't over-parented. There's something that's happened in modern parenting. I don't know where it morphed into a competition, but it kind of has. And it's one of my biggest challenges. I upset parents everywhere when I challenge them on this. There is no competition. There never has been. We as a collective should be raising our children together as we used to for the benefit of all of us, but ultimately for the benefit of each child to become whoever they're wired to be, not who we'd like them to be. And I think the mothers have a lot to do with the expectations that they put on top of our boys at times. Often when I'm working with a boy who's doing some strange things, it'll come back to separation, some particular forms. We think they're tough, so we'll just push them out. And whereas we might soothe a young girl who's five when mummy leaves her at preschool or whatever, we will not. We will tend to push them to toughen them. The scar stays. The scar's very, very sensitive, and separation becomes a big issue. That's why I encourage families, please, to get pets that die quite early on, you know, because that is something that helps boys and girls prepare for the death of things, that there's a sequence, it hurts, the pain in the chest does go. I did have one mum say she got a dog so that it would die one day, but the boy left home before it died. So I don't recommend dogs, I actually recommend guinea pigs and things. Preferably something they can also stroke, because it's vital in those early years to know what soft is or tender is. I know every woman in the room wants a man who knows what soft touch is. Do you know, like instead of, is that all right? Probably a little bit gentler, darling. And that vital window, there's only one other window we've got before it's too late to develop that sensitivity, and that's that little window just before early adolescence when the brain's doing strange things. So they're vital things that mothers need to be responsible for making sure that they happen. We can test the cortisol levels of stress in children and distress in them, and sometimes we think boys are fine just because there's no outward sign, you know, that they're not travelling too well. This reminds me of the flash of the boys. Sand pits are really big in my world. Obviously, I didn't have a farm for them to run around, so I used to have loads of sand delivered quite often because I got them outside. And my lawn was quite bumpy, really, because, you know, they put loads everywhere and the lawn grows up, and the lawnmower man used to be going like this forever. But this thing about sand pits and their space away from mothers, too many damn questions, and why don't you do it like this? The freedom to be able to play. And we're going to touch play in a moment, but the boys all walked out one day when we were down in Dunsborough to go surfing, all four of them were surfers, and there's this truck had just dumped a big load of sand for a new building over the road. I saw the four of them pause at the same time, looked at it and went, God, I bet Mum's throwing the tonkers out. They were aged 25, 23, 21 and 18, and they just looked at that sand pit going, we could rip that up, but we'll go surfing today. So the whole sense of what boys and how they see the world. The play part is something I'm really concerned about, really, really concerned about, because our children now are wired with their thumbs. They're wired to sit on couches and play. They are not out in our natural world, swinging out of trees, nearly drowning in the creek and burning down hay sheds like they used to. They're not learning from the real world. It is impacting enormously. And I believe, Arnie, that's one of the main reasons we're pushing up our suicide rate, because it isn't nurturing this place within that must be developed, like a seeking mechanism of playing with the world. We've become paranoid about that. And I bet every one of you had, well, there's some very young people in the room, maybe not you, but you had times when you could run amok and play without parents supervising you. Yes, we rode bikes with no bloody gears, no brakes, no helmets. Yes, we did fall off and hurt ourselves, and we learnt what that felt like, and we could get over it. Yes? It was also older children looking after younger children, which was how we learnt responsibility. Some of us got our backsides kicked if we lost them, or they got injured. So we learnt responsibility quite early, not something you talk about in class and hope they suck it through the genes in their skin, because that's not how we learn values. Values need to be embodied in a real world. I have seen the behaviour changes of children quite quickly, and there's a lot of research out there now that will show to you that the more they play these violent games, the more they will get aggro. But the worst, scariest windows in adolescence, when that pruning is taking place, when addictions can even quicker to absorb, a boy we have got lots more, mainly boys, that play that horrible Warcrafty one they play all night. They can change their personality permanently in just 6 to 8 weeks, which is the school holidays. And we can't get that personality back. We have to get them back out into the real world, into real play, with preferably things called human beings. Do you know the two-legged? Yeah. Pleasure-seeking part of the brain is another thing which I think is driving depression for people, is that there are two kind of patterns in our brain that we develop as children, a pain-seeking part and a pleasure-seeking part. The pleasure-seeking part means that children are meant to experience moments of joy and delight, yet they're chaotic, they're noisy, they're unpredictable, they're spontaneous, they're a pain in the neck. But if it's joy that they're building a neural pathway to anticipate, that's what it feels like. So without that mechanism happening often enough, with things especially around, you know, Easter bunnies and dumb things that are actually fantasy, then there's a chance that they're going to rely mainly on the pain-seeking part, the part that there's hurt. Now, so things suck anyway, it's only going to get worse, you know, everything that happens to me, you know, goes belly up. You know, that sort of, that we can train those sort of patterns and thinking loops because children can escape them as children. We know that games build emotion, social skills. How do you think you learn to wait, lose, take turns? Yep, we do it through play. And I think every single family needs to burn out, at least wear out completely, 2 Uno packs, 2 fish packs, 2 snakes and ladders, Connect Four. And do you know, every one of you in there, you know, you're older and your prefrontal lobes are all developed, they look like them. But I guarantee if I gave you a snakes and ladders game with a 4-year-old and you were winning and you got that damn snake on the second top row, I guarantee there's part of you that goes a bit pissy. We still don't like losing, but we get to deal with it better, don't we? Although there's some mothers, you know, that if their children gang up on them on a Uno game, they have to pick up 24 cards. She's quietly saying in her head, well, no dessert for a week. Fix them, because she's not mature either. Healthy imaginations, creativity and flexible thinking all come from lots of play. And thinking creatively and flexibly is going to be incredibly important in our world. And anything that mothers can do that she doesn't get in the road of that is really helpful. Creatively flexible thinking. And in adolescence, it's a really big one, because our first thing we want to do too is go to critical parents and say, what the heck were you thinking of? Do the pause and the centering, thinking, now there's probably other solutions to the way you did that. You know, what might else could you have done other than strangle your brother? Vigorous play diffuses lots of gunk. I had 2 roosters and 2 lambs. I think you probably know what that difference is. Roosters, they turn up on the planet from the minute they're born, pecking at you, cock-a-doodle-doodling, pushing you around, arguing with you, pushing boundaries, burning down sheds, all sorts of things, and drive you incredibly insane. You love them. Then you have lambs, and lambs come on, you'd have 15 of them, because they're patient, loving, they adore their mothers, they're very gentle souls, say please and thank you. However, roosters need a lot of vigorous play for them to be even remotely able to live in the same house as them. So lots of trip to the park to burn gunk out of the motor will actually help home harmony, because they are energetic, they are strong characters, and they've come here to do something that they need, that big character. In my years working in funerals, as I've done thousands of weddings and funerals, I used to sit at the back sometimes when I wasn't doing them, thinking, I'd love to listen to the stories and go, God, I wish I knew that bloke or that lady. And I noticed there was a theme that used to come up, that sometimes the most significant men in communities who were leaders, who were doing amazing things, when someone did their eulogy, they were complete buggers for their mothers. Can you imagine raising Steve Irwin? You know, Peter Brock. Do you know, highly energetic people drive the average woman insane. However, we mustn't crush that, and it's part of like crushing their innateness, that it does help us. And there are some women who like to keep really tidy houses. It's not good, really, raising boys. Tidy houses don't go in the same thing very well. I don't know, haven't met any boys yet who actually can cook toast and then wipe the bench. This does not happen. Does not come on the gene pool. I love them. Just didn't happen. I'd know when there was a girl or a niece in the house, because I'd go, oh my God, my bench has been wiped. Not that they can't learn it. And that's also what we need to do as mothers, that not look after them so much. We have to teach them some of those skills. Yeah. I know that the whole bringing washing off the line, any of you have actually had sons or know if you can ask them to do that. If you had eye contact with you and they heard you, because otherwise they didn't hear you, did they? They can get them, and then it depends, really, their personality shows how they bring them off the line, because roosters pull them with the pegs are still intact, the pile goes up and the foot goes on top. And when you go in and say, oh, could have folded them, whoop, you said, just bring the washing in. Whereas lambs can fold them, bring them in. I had one experience with one of my boys. You know, a rooster came home in year four and said, oh, Mum, I'm in the high jump and I'm going to win. And first time that he's been in it. And I said, oh, sweetheart, you're a bit short. It's not really a high chance, love. You're trying to ease him into the failure that's coming. It's very imminent. And also, neither side of the family has any boing in their legs. So we don't jump. We do really good basketball and football. And he proceeded to think he was going to win. He got tossed out in the first round. But what was really sad is as he's bawling in the back of the car, gutted. And there's one thing I say there, let them feel it for a while before you soothe them. We must know how it feels like to lose and be gutted before we rescue or... And what was really tragic about it was that one of the boys who got through only had one leg. He had a very good leg, the other leg cut off with cancer. His family had really good genes. There is such an issue with that. You know, at 21st, you can bring up some tragic stories at the 21st. But the older brother said, whatever you do, Mum, just leave the high jump story out. Because he has a scar there, and I think that's helpful for them. It shapes the man they become, that they have to overcome that. And it doesn't do much high jump in his life anymore. One other thing I need to recommend, that's something that women don't do terribly well. We're not really good at the scary stuff with children. You know, blokes chuck them up and spin them. They go, put him down, please don't let them do that. Make sure they throw them. Because we now know that the cerebellum gets developed through spinning, tumbling and rough play. And you don't get that sitting on a couch with a thing on your lap. And small, underdeveloped cerebellums are coming up really high in research with ADHD and hyperactivity. So thank you, dads. Please keep doing the stuff that you've always done that us women aren't really comfortable with, because we know now how vital it is for brain development. We know the autonomy one is a huge one, because we tend to want to control our children lots, but they need to be able to make some decisions, and it's one of the reasons we have play leaders in schools. In hospitals, sorry, not schools, where children have, say, cancer, they have to have a lumbar puncture, but they can choose whether they have their face painted or they play a game. Autonomy is incredibly important, and that's one of the things that the over-smothering mother does. She takes away their choices, and they feel incredibly powerless, and it builds a deep and profound rage that will usually come out at some point. And we do get rid of stress and anxiety, which is a goodie. Another one, of course, that Tim Gills explored in his book, No Fear, we're taking all the risks out of our playgrounds and out of our world. And that's the scary thing, because the things that boys need to do to become alive, to get that spirit going sometimes, scare the heck out of us as women. I have a pretty tricky rule in my house that says, anything risky you plan on doing, tell me afterwards. Not before, because I don't need to worry. Yeah, it is something that they need to kind of explore, and that overprotected and overheld one, or the one that's given 15,000 lectures on why it's dangerous, is doing something, I believe, innately that's holding back boys from being whoever they need to be. We know that our playgrounds have been quite bizarre. We took down the big monkey bars, you know, because people broke their arms. Now, it's really, really weird that those monkey bars, because you had to hang, were a really, really powerful way of strengthening our wrists. We've now actually got out there, a physiotherapist was telling me, the statistics for breaking arms hasn't changed at all. In actual fact, I think it's increased, because children will break a wrist now just falling over walking, because they haven't had the monkey bars to do the vital here. And those people who broke their arms on monkey bars, when you ask them, did they die from it? I haven't had a fatality yet. But what they did learn was, you know, sometimes you get spoilt when you've got a broken arm, people look after you, there's some payoff, but it recovers. And that where the bone was, where it knits, it's twice as strong. I think we need to look at what we're doing with our playgrounds. That's actually diminishing not just boys but girls as well, at being able to manage risk. Tim Gill says that there's studies in the UK with the safe playgrounds, with those safe black things and everything low down, not those big seesaws that could knock your jaw out, and you know, those, and the maypoles that could really, really spin and then vomit. Well, the reason is now that the injuries are exactly the same, because children go into them thinking they are safe. We used to go into those scary ones and we had to take care. Shapes up the way we do things in our mind.
And we'll be back with the final part of Maggie Dent's keynote after this track.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you're ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air. We're listening to Maggie Dent, recorded live at the MAN National Conference in Fremantle, Western Australia, in August 2008.
Other doorways that women and mothers can help with their sons is through the mouth. There is no question that there is some innate thing in that, because it's a very... we like it. We like food. And as they got towards adolescence, I recognised sometimes a big, substantial, wholesome food meal after a traumatic day at the war zone of school was probably the best thing I could do as a mother. Nourish them. I made sure there wasn't rubbish in our house. I was a Gestapo, you can ask them. There was no cool drink in our house, no chips, no crap. There was at parties, and other than that was not available. They all had beautiful bodies. I keep saying it's because of me. They don't agree, they just say it's just because they're just so gorgeous. But I do notice they only cook in a similar way now, very fresh. Very interesting. So we shape the way they eat from what we allow them to have. And I think mothers still control most of the kitchens, and they need to be very careful that you're making decisions for life. We must not either soothe and smother them with food, because that then becomes a crutch. There are certain boys too that the first thing they do will be walk in the house and open the fridge door. They are wired. I've found they're actually usually born around November, those people. They're called Scorpios. They're also the ones that sometimes you'll find in the ice cream in the fridge, a spoon still in there. Got caught out, yep. They're also the one that'll hide the Milo tin in their bedroom so they can get more of it. What was a bit sad when that one left home was we found three tins, big tins, with the spoon rock solid into the rock solid, because he forgot he'd hidden it as well. Love them. Love little lads and food. Another one that concerns me a lot, that we're in such a hurried up world. We keep pushing and pushing and pushing, and I think boys are really, really, really susceptible to stress from being pushed and hurried along. We know there, I think Julian says, we're about 3,000 words behind by 3 or 4. And then we're expecting to get reading earlier and testing earlier. Now, my oldest, when he turned up at grade one, couldn't write his whole name too well, because really we hadn't caught him very often to practice that. He could count really well, lots and lots of games of Heidi and Chasey. And there was something else he was delayed development with. I can't remember what that one. Oh, shoelaces. I couldn't catch them to teach them. So they had lackey-sided boots, because there was four sons. It goes, you know, they last the whole four. Unbelievably economical. Pull on, done. And so he's, and I've sat him, taken him to his first day of school, and he sits down, and I'm the old English teacher. He sits down next to a boy reading Charlotte's Web. Well, as a mother, that was it, where I thought I completely failed him. Fortunately, after two pieces of carrot cake and several cups of cappuccino and a big box of tissues and several girlfriends, I was able to defuse the emotional trauma for me. That particular boy went through with that boy for 6 years until mine wouldn't tuck his shirt in, because it was a Catholic school and I had to go off to the government system. The nice boy with the nice manners went straight through to there and then off to Aquinas and then off to Notre Dame to become a lawyer. My scrubber went through the government system, which was fabulous for him. Yes, he did party, play football, served, had a girlfriend and everything else I don't need to know about and keep telling him not to tell me about. Scraped into university with one rank, which is not very much. One rank into commerce. Then ended up in third year ringing me and saying, you're sitting down, Mum, because I've thought, I've looked at my results and the ones I did best in are the law units. I might stay on and do law. What do you think? And the part of me that pays the bills goes, bugger. And the part that says, oh, that's lovely, because I'm proud of you, said, that's lovely, darling. So he stayed on. He ended up getting into law and he ended up at the same practice as the boy who read Charlotte's Web. Today's system, he would need special attention. He's a delayed developer today. That's what worries me, are the labels we're putting on our boys quite early by curriculum-driven systems that say you've got to reach benchmarks instead of honouring the development of boys that's different to girls. Okay, essentially these are the things. If we can learn to communicate around our boys with what I call warm relation, or good communication, without drowning them in words, questions, interrogation, nagging, lecturing, and generally using way too many words, we can open up a space where they feel safe. It is extremely difficult, even though I'm part bloke. When they come home and they've been away somewhere, there's this part of me that wants to ask a million questions. Do you know what? I see them after, say they've come home from whatever and they're having a coffee and reading the paper and I'm going, right, don't ask any questions. Come back in and go, pace, pace, pace. Wait, wait. It is so hard. So hard for us as women to shut up. I want to know. It has been the hardest thing I've had to do. Sometimes I've wanted to mask my mouth to let them know how difficult it is for me. It's been funny because when their prefrontal lobe develops later, they can actually recognise that I did shut up and they can say thank you. It's very, very hard. I think this is something also that Maggie's book came out with and I really loved and valued it, was very much the fact that our narrative, both verbally and non-verbally, affects our boys hugely. And you know that our prior experiences shape our belief system. So if you've met a few toads in your life and think that men are, dickheads or whatever, you know, unless we've healed that, we will transfer that onto our sons, verbally or otherwise. And it's very, very particular. I had to fight really, really hard to instill the values around home, not just towards boys and men, but towards women. I had a complete testosterone house. And there were times I had to pause at meals and say, hang on, stop, no, that's really not okay. There's a lady present. And they'd go, where? And there were times, you know, in that journey, into that whole sexual journey off there, that I might call one of them out onto the deck, which is where I had my little chats, and I'd sit with my elbows at the back and say, little birdies told me, because I never wanted to dob in who'd let me know, I'm a little bit worried about it, and then let them explore whatever that issue was. Yep, they did challenge me on lots of levels, and my first voice in my head was the one that wanted to be a bitch. But if I breathed, my second one wanted to be an adult ally that brought the best out in them. Yep. Wasn't always successful. Wasn't always. They went to Bali and did everything I wish they'd never done. And I wish they hadn't told me. It took me weeks to get over it. But we must be very mindful that our interior monologue that we run about the world and ourself and relationships is impacting on our boys deeply. I even hear what we say to our girlfriends. I don't know how to do that. Okay, boundaries and space. This is the other one that I think really impacts, and I think it's like a holistic view that helps boys, is that they do have physical and emotional space from us. And then they have the space when they want to be close. Yep. And when do we say, and I have mothers sometimes say to me, well, he keeps crawling into our bed and he's 9. There's something wrong with it. And when we identify when he crawls into his bed, it's when he's had an absolute shit day at school and people have been at him and he's got his head's just done in with how to deal with it. So instead of having a conversation or identifying he's out of sorts, he crawls into the place the four-year-old wants to crawl into. He just wants to be near somebody that's going to make him feel safe. Sometimes it's in the middle or it's between dad or it's... He needs that space where he's been safe before. We need to not judge how many times you need to do that. Really, really careful on that one. Just it does get a bit tricky when they're doing it every night because it really mucks up the sex life. Really tricky. And I think it's an insult too that, you know, we lock the door, because that's not always good either, is it, really? It sort of says, you're not welcome in here. Maybe once a month. Okay. Boys in nature, to encourage mums to find a space that they like. If they're a tree boy, where's a tree that they really like? If they're a rock person, where is it? If there's an ocean they love, where is it? And visit it. And then get out the road, get yourself a coffee. And do you know what I mean? I think we've got to be able to let them find their space that resonates with them, because it will stay with them for life. It's much easier if it's built in childhood. It's much harder for me to build that doorway as adolescents. Boys need space to figure out what the heck is going on. Now, laughter is an essential part of mothering sons healthily. It's the only way to survive to start with. But it does help you if you have multiples of them, because there are times when they can be quite tricky and challenging. The lighter you are, the more chance they will come to you, because we won't shame and blame and do the whole stuff that we sometimes do on them. Now, one of the things that happened early was in adolescence, when they actually muck up, it's not always easy to keep your sense of humour, is it? No. Especially when it's really close to the bone, like, you know, it's your car, they've pranged. So it's really, really hard, but that's one of the biggest things we can do that allows them to make a mistake, own it, deal with it, arrange to fix it. It's just restorative justice. If they're not aware of the pathways of fixing something, they've buggered up, we disable them quite often for life. And I remember in different situations, telling a joke is an enormous part of boyhood, manhood, and humour is what helps boys, especially in workplaces, don't they? Because they can be sent off there at 15 to go and find the left-handed screwdriver and the black and white striped paint. When they can't find it, get desperately laughed at. If they haven't got a sense of humour, which we help cultivate, they can be scarred. There were times in the house in adolescence, I do remember, when I had to very surreptitiously walk around my narrow kitchen weaving in between erect penises, because it was that time that they're not embarrassing them at all. But also I need to get my breakfast as well. You need to be really okay with that. You cannot shame that. The fact that they might have to watch TV playing with their bits, you know, and be okay with that is a really empowering thing for a young man to do that without going, oh God, I better get out there if someone's going on. I have to coach people at weddings sometimes too to tell them that I've never had a scrotum fall off, so you won't need to check it during the ceremony. The art of letting go. This is one of the hardest things we do as women. And we need to let go at different stages. That's why I love the idea of rites of passage, because it's something that says it speaks to us as well, that we need to step back. And you know that Celia says we need to get off the bridge and let them go on it. Quite often that what drives the anger of boys is that mums aren't letting them step back. We still stay connected, but somehow or other we need to work with them. It's when you tell me when you need me to step back, because they're different. Roosters and lambs are quite different, and we need to honour that. We know that over 20, until they're at 25, they're still highly at risk. They do actually need their mums, but in a different context. I'd like to read a little piece as we head towards this last minute, because this one, the letting go part causes a lot of problems for women. The empty nest causes a lot of problems for women. But it's much easier to let roosters go than it is to let the lambs go. I wrote this piece not long after number two left, because he's the lamb. Needless to say, over the last 20-odd years that I've cooked and cleaned and run about, laughed with, cried with, worried about these lads of mine in every permutation possible, it's time, I know, to let another one go. The oldest, the rooster, when he left the city a couple of years ago, it was quite easy. Really, a sideways shoulder hug is about as emotional as he got. I found it a bit sad, but really didn't cry many tears. Whew, house was quieter. And then last week, I had to let my second six-foot baby leave home. I thought because I'd done it once, it'd be really easily. Not so. This one was the placid baby, the understanding patient child, the nature lover with the unexpected sense of humour, the thrill seeker up the trees and in the waves of the oceans. He's so much harder to let go. He's the one who calls at work, just says, what can I cook for dinner? Brings the washing in without being asked, mostly folded. Asks if you want a coffee and genuinely asks if it's okay to do things when he knows he can make his own decisions. So much harder to let go. He's the one who's the animal lover, feeds the cat, eats his breakfast with her on his lap. The good friend who stays loyal and supportive no matter what. not afraid to hug lingeringly and chat to family friends warmly. The one who was there for his mate when his dad died suddenly, so much harder to let go. But I have, and my heart's still heavy, and it tugs when I call to say hi. Being a mother was always going to have its moments, and I'm sharing this with all of you to remind you to be grateful of every moment in your sons and daughters' lives while they're there in the family home. Don't waste time on nagging, growling, let go, and love more often. Laugh with them, stand beside them as they discover who they are, independent of you. And above all this is my final message, that when they choose to leave, let them go. No matter how much you want to hang on, keep them. Let them go. It may be the hardest and the kindest thing that you will ever do as a mother. I'm finished.
And that was Maggie Dent speaking live at the MAN National Conference in August 2008. If you'd like to find out more about Maggie, you can go to her website, which is maggiedent.com. That's maggiedent.com. And available there, you'll find her, all of her books, including her most recent book that we chatted to her about on this program a few weeks ago, called Real Kids in an Unreal World.
With dads on the air, we're here 'cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.